You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show, reports emerge that the last rebel pocket in Aleppo could fall at any moment. My guests today, Rosemary Hollis and Sebastian Borgo, will give us their take on this and the day's other top stories, including Donald Trump's new Secretary of State and his ties with Russia. Should we be concerned? We also look at the latest on the UK's departure from the EU as Chancellor Philip Hammond calls for a form of transitional deal. And welcome back, Spain. The government's considering leaving the Franco era behind and reversing the clocks 1 hour, putting Spain together with the UK and Portugal in the GMT time zone. More on that later. And plenty more besides ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger and Rosemary Hollis. Sebastian's the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Rosemary is a professor of international politics at City University London. Welcome both to Midori House. Great to have you with us, as always. We start today's programme in Aleppo. According to the Syrian army, the battle for control of the city is now in its final stages, with the rebels facing complete defeat in the city. Residents in the east have sent out desperate messages imploring the international community to save civilians as forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad clamp down on the very small area still under rebel control. Rosemary, perhaps we'll start with you. Tens of thousands of civilians are trapped, and many are saying now a bad situation has worsened and worsened. We're now in some kind of doomsday scenario. Do we know enough to describe it accurately thus?
As a doomsday scenario. I think it's appalling for Western publics to watch this and realise that their governments can't offer them any way of intervening to stop the slaughter of helpless civilians. And that has to do, I think, with an understanding that has developed in the West since the Second World War, that there are laws of war, that there are human rights and protections for those human rights, and that on the whole, in the contemporary era, we don't do mass slaughter of civilians. But I don't think that's an accurate reflection of what has happened in most wars around the world since the Second World War. And in the Second World War itself, civilians were very much part of the fighting, and civilian deaths were not considered an abuse of the laws of war. They were considered a tactic to be used in war. Now, looking at Syria, apart from the distress of those of us on the outside who can do nothing much, and the realization that that makes us potentially guilty of being a party to this, it is hard to find the logic of the Assad regime. What kind of a country do they think they will end up with at the end of all of this? A completely crushed, defeated population may be quiet for a while, but the children will grow up in poverty, in deprivation, and being told that it was all the fault of the Assad regime. And the victory is being delivered not just by Syrian army forces loyal to the Assad regime, but from Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon, a number of Iranians organized by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps to assist the Assad regime, some conscripts that the Iranians have got together, including Afghans. So how is this going to be a Syrian future, a national victory in any sense?
Some challenging questions about the longer term. We understand, Sebastian, that the Russian ambassador to the UN suggests a deal has been agreed for rebel fighters to leave the east, the embattled east of the city of Aleppo. It's still not clear if that applies to the civilians who are similarly constrained there, which I guess is little relief. And to go back to what Rosemary was saying about this feeling of powerlessness and then a worry even of somehow, complicity almost in what's happening through our inability to act, that news certainly won't bring any, doesn't seem to bring any, the promise of any relief.
Well, I have to, I first of all, I don't feel complicit. I know that our governments haven't been engaged enough, or when they try to get engaged, like the British government in the summer of 2014, was voted down by Parliament. Let's not forget that. And of course, Obama talking about red lines and then not acting upon them. My own government.
I think that's what I mean by complicit. Plus the fact that all of this dates back to the intervention in Iraq, and this assumption that you can remake countries.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm not complicit because my government wasn't involved in
that's
Iraq,
fair.
And my government was not putting out any red lines. In fact, I have to say, I would have probably argued for a stronger stance initially in 2011, when Germany, of course, when we were talking about Libya, Germany abstained in the Security Council, which I thought was pretty shameful back then. But of course, maybe I've got to correct myself there. Anyway, so this is water under the bridge, but. I'm not sure there's much point in talking about complicity, is there? The point is...
Well, I suppose I'm so full up with the kind of responses I get every time I spend time in the region that we've abandoned them, that we're responsible for all the terrible things that happen, that Assad is a puppet of greater forces internationally, and so on.
Yeah.
So I don't see much room for reconciliation from the outsiders with the insiders.
So perhaps complicity, then there's clearly a failure, and it certainly created, if there was a failure from the governments, be it Germany, the US, certainly the UK, it created a vacuum which obviously Putin and the Russians have exploited very, very capably to their own ends.
If there is a guilty party outside, it is Russia, I would argue, and of course Iran as well. But of course they're propping up their dictator. They like Assad in charge, and the West didn't like Assad, which is honourable, but wasn't sure what to do after Assad or instead of Assad. So in that sense, it's a failure of Western, Middle Eastern policy. I agree on that, isn't it? Obviously, and we're heartbroken. That's the problem. We look at these pictures and films on social media, and you know, you'd have to have a heart of stone if you weren't moved by them.
And just to pick back up, Rosemary, what you were saying about, you know, the cost that's involved in this by Assad, and that perhaps the lack of a strategy that makes sense in the longer term about what this country might look like. Again, if we look elsewhere in the country, you have Islamic State militants supposedly retaking Palmyra or making small gains again. So he still remains so far away from having any kind of coherent hold on even a bulk of the country. Why is there no engagement with that longer term picture? Presumably Assad is driven purely by short-term political expediency and almost a survival instinct almost, so it might make sense from his point of view, but no one else seems engaged in that longer term picture. Or, you know, is Putin engaged in that way?
Oh, I think Putin is perfectly capable of thinking in the longer term, and I think he has staggered his agenda, which started out with denying the Americans another regime change to the satisfaction of Washington, but not Moscow. And he's achieved that. And then to lump together all those who oppose a duly constituted regime, this issue of sovereignty before the responsibility to protect was introduced in the late 1990s as a possible mediator or ameliorator of the whole idea that you do not interfere in other countries' affairs. I mean, that the Russians have succeeded in that too. I think down the line, however, they are expecting that the Western players will have an interest in restabilizing the area, and that they won't be left on their own to live with the mess that they've helped create in Syria. And I wouldn't be too sure about that, actually, because I think they could be revisiting the Afghanistan experience, where their man was in place. in Kabul, but the Americans were still helping the Mujahideen, who were making life impossible, and the Russians, the Soviets at the time, were eventually forced out. And the equivalent of the Mujahideen are still alive and well, including ISIS, and are still well supported by the Saudis, which is a bit the same as US support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, because it's by proxy.
But the difference, of course, being that the West never knew who to support, because, you know, we
made... In Syria. Well, they did make some promises that they were supporting the so-called moderates.
Yes. They did. And where are they?
And they are the ones that principally feel let down, because they were led to believe that they would be helped to succeed. They themselves asked in the early days, please don't do this regime change for us. We must be in the forefront of this. But then there weren't enough defectors from the Assad regime. So that meant, in effect, that the outsiders, especially in London and Washington, were misreading the signals of the fragility of the Assad regime. If you run a regime, I believe, in a barbaric way, and you finger all the people whose loyalty you need, they cannot afford to abandon you when there's a revolution, when there's a rebellion, because the population will not be forgiving those who had made the past dictatorship possible. And now the stakes are even higher. It's nobody's going to expect any forgiveness or reconciliation in Syrian society. It's going to get even more ugly.
A sobering thought. Let's move on and turn the focus to the United States. Unfortunately, that means Donald Trump. Rosemary and Sebastian, there's a few angles to unpack here. Perhaps let's start with the latest cabinet nominations. This has garnered a great deal of speculation and interest. The appointment, though, Sebastian, of the chief executive of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, as Secretary of State. I was going to ask you, how controversial a move is this? I'm sort of running out of the right questions to ask. What do you make of this play, this particular play from Trump?
Fascinating, because I was sitting around a dinner table last night. We were obviously discussing Trump, and I said, well, look, I mean, it's a terrible nomination. It would be a terrible nomination, but it hasn't happened yet. Half a day later, it has happened. So there we are. Look, the man clearly has great experience abroad. Let's put the few plus points first. The man is used to leading a big bureaucracy, which a company of 75,000 people necessarily is. The man at least is not a climate change denier. So that's the pluses. The minuses are obvious. To take, you know, I know CEOs deal with all sorts of unpleasant regimes out of necessity, but to take honors from someone like Putin in pursuance of your company's balance, trade balance is really, I think, beyond the pale. Mm. So well, first of all, let's see, will he get through the Senate hearings? That'll be tough, I have no doubt. If he does, I wonder whether we won't see another Alexander Haig, who crashed and burned within 18 months of being Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State.
Whereas we pick up a couple of those points, which are, you know, pretty relevant here. What about the prospects of this being approved? It's by no means rubber stamped, but then we're not really used to seeing this kind of appointment, you know, going before the Senate. What do your instincts tell you? And if he does get the job, how long will he be there for?
Well, I'm not sure that we ought to focus only on that nomination. I think across the board, there are different reasons for concern with several of the nominations. But coming in the context of Donald Trump's simple dismissal of what the CIA are claiming about Russian meddling in the US election, one wonders how he will respond to a Congress that grills his nominees and starts to put obstacles in his way. It Here we're dealing with the post-truth era, where the people who have just found themselves on the winning side with voters, with the populace, are simply dismissing any information, any obstacles, as the losers trying to reverse the results of the vote, as opposed to taking these things seriously. And to what extent will US voters, US congressmen and women, go along with a president who seems not to care about the system that they've invested their careers in serving? So in order to avoid the accusation that they're anti-democratic and that they won't go with the say-so of the people, if they want Donald Trump, they are entitled to have Donald Trump. So I see the established politicians completely flummoxed.
Well, they're entitled to have Donald Trump, but they're not entitled to have a CEO of Exxon as their Secretary of State. I mean, that's the system. And I think...
Yes, but if Trump dismisses the system...
Yes, but you know, he's coming up against forces which he hasn't yet come up against, I think. I mean, let's not assume that the rather older established democracy of American of the United States will simply keel over because a slightly loose marbled businessman has made it into the White House.
Are you still a big believer, Sebastian, in this idea that, you know, there are checks and balances, and even somebody as volatile, as unpredictable, and as seemingly as contemptuous of public opinion and the advice of experts as Trump, will be sort of held in check to some respect?
The same thing is true of, you know, his Twitter pronouncements about the One China policy, about the taking the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, all of that. You know, it could happen, and then he will encounter forces which he hasn't yet reckoned with, and you know, particularly China, and then we will see of what stuff the man is made, and how the you know, there is a Congress, there is the American military who at once stage, sooner or later, he will have to call upon.
Well, what about the possibility? I mean, because at the moment you're describing King Canute standing on the seashore and commanding the tide not to come in or to go out, and discovering that the forces are stronger than him and he can't have his will. But he has a pattern of throwing out these absurd suggestions, shocking everybody. And this is in his deal-making, we're told, in the business world. And then coming up with a perfectly acceptable compromise. So how are we to judge what is designed to shock and to open the ground for successful negotiations? I mean, I can see some of this with the One China policy. I can see an appeal in the logic which says, why am I bound by this? And why can't I make it, if I'm to continue with it, that the Chinese have got to concede some of the things that I got elected to address? I think it could be considered very clever. And so I don't think the US system and its traditions is prepared for this.
I share your puzzlement, Rosemary. We don't know, of course. We don't know how it'll pan out. What I'm saying is, yes, I mean, if he uses Taiwan as a bargaining chip, that's clearly... I mean, when I first heard it, I have to say, I thought that was refreshing, because I always thought, well, you know, we've got this it used to be a terrible military dictatorship. It's made a very successful transition to a good democracy with changes of power, etc. People are much better off than people on mainland China. So we pretend it isn't there and doesn't exist. It's very, very odd. But then, of course, I read up on what he said, and he said, well, if China does what I want, namely take away tariffs for American goods, then I don't care about Taiwan. Well, that's what I mean. I think those are the things that people... He will learn. He can't be you know, the man isn't dumb. He can't be, although I slightly contradict myself here, but he can't, you know, he will learn that you cannot treat allies and friends like that as bargaining chips. It doesn't work. It doesn't work in foreign policy. I don't have to tell you. It doesn't work in foreign policy generally, but it certainly doesn't work if you're the remaining superpower.
I'm trying to keep an open mind here because I would agree with you absolutely, but that this is the tradition and what we expect, and it's not a good tactic to get cooperation. However, I am also conscious of a generation of youngsters who think the existing traditional system is broken.
It's not only youngsters, it's a lot of oldsters, isn't it?
With the oldsters, the left behinds and all the rest of us, I think they're less looking for a revolution that takes them forward than one that takes them back to a golden age when manufacturing meant safe jobs. And I simply cannot see Donald Trump delivering on that. However, I think some youngsters are so sick of the swamp that he described that they are happy with an iconoclast rather than more of the same.
Well, and we shall see how that pans out. 5 weeks before he's even inaugurated, let's not forget. This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Sebastian Borger and Rosemary Hollis are here. Another one of your favourite topics from 2016, Brexit, on the way next.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
AM 1821 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me, Sebastian Borger and Rosemary Hollis. Time to talk Brexit. There's some pained faces here in studio. The UK's Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has perhaps opened a rift with his cabinet colleagues. He says the UK will not be able to leave the EU within 2 years without serious side effects, adding that thoughtful politicians would agree. He added that a transitional deal in which the UK would pay for access to the single market for about 24 months after leaving the EU would help to ensure a smooth Brexit. Sebastian, to you first. What do you make of what Hammond's had to say from a domestic political point of view and in terms of the bigger picture?
Well, domestically fascinating, because of course Downing Street reacted puzzled, I think. They didn't know what was hitting them. And they haven't slapped him down, which they would do with anything that Boris Johnson says, or indeed the Foreign Secretary, or indeed the Brexit Secretary, David Davis. So that it tells us that Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is really the strongest cabinet minister in that sense. What he says, of course, is what the governor of the Bank of England has consistently said for weeks now. And I think Hammond's description is correct when he says every thoughtful politician. And he said this side and the other side of the channel. Well, in other words, in Brussels as well.
This is an interesting point, Rosemary. Do you think are we finally arriving to a bit a time where we find maybe some, if not shared ground, that might be too much to hope for, but some thinking or some rhetoric on this issue that does marry up on either side of the channel? Or is that too much to hope?
I'm waiting for when the politicians can talk about, for want of a better term, facts, the realities of the complications. I think any mention of the numbers of pieces of paper involved in the legislation over the years that Britain's been in the EU, which have to be revisited, and the numbers of new civil servants devoted to different tasks that will be required, and so on. I think the people talking about that and the necessary funds that will have to be spent to deal with all of this have been dismissed so far as trying to reverse Brexit. And I think Hammond, along with David Davis, actually, I don't think he would have been slapped down because he was once and he's been playing a very canny game since then, are looking at, let's assume we're going to do all of this. Now, how do we make the costs manageable? As opposed to saying, look how unmanageable the costs are, how unmanageable the tasks are, maybe we should reconsider. So there's a sort of shift of strategy, the net message of which, however, might be which members of the cabinet are going to take the flak for a very costly decision.
And in another piece of news, which was interesting in the last couple of days, Sebastian, an outbreak maybe of some pragmatism. Maybe that's too much to hope for. The European Commission's Brexit team has suggested that EU citizens living in the UK remain covered by, ECJ rulings, for example, after the country leaves the bloc, which is another interesting notion. But again, is that feasible? Is this just a feeler that's being put out there? What do you make of some of the, I don't know, slightly more pragmatic, noises we're hearing?
Well, that's. I think I totally agree with you that there is a kind of pragmatism from both sides coming out. We've had quite a bit of rhetoric from Juncker and from Schulz the EU Commission President and the President of the European Parliament, and even Guy Verhofstadt, the Brexit negotiator of the Parliament, was quite tough a few weeks ago. He now sounds much more emollient. And I think that is in reaction to the fact, what Rosemary describes, that David Davis, who came bragging along in the summer, has reined himself in and is talking a much more astute game, supported by Hammond. It's interesting that these two, Davis, of course, a Brexiteer, long-standing Europhobe, Hammond, a pragmatic supporter of the EU, are coming together. Whereas someone like Boris Johnson, I think, is still
well, the contradictions
not part of that
in
team.
His various pronouncements seem to be the problem with Boris Johnson. Actually, this whole outburst about the Saudis, the coverage of the significance of that, I think, has been all over the place. It's not so much that he spoke a truth and then was expected to backtrack on it and that he was slapped down and he's made use of by Theresa May as a scapegoat and all the rest of it. I think the problem is that if the cozy relationship between Britain and the Saudis continues unflustered and the defence sales continue and the security cooperation continue, then poor old Boris looks even worse for suggesting that there was some moral concerns in the relationship, blurting it out and then doing nothing about it.
All of which, of course, is so important for Britain post-Brexit, isn't it? You cannot simply
the
country can't give up on its cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia when at the same time
and
as
the
it's
Gulf
giving
States.
Up. The cozy relationship with the European Union.
Let me jump in there. I did want to quickly head to Spain before the end of the show. Briefly about a series of measures announced by the Employment Minister, Fatima Bañez, about improving the work-life balance. The end of the working day at 6 rather than 8 p.m, but also announcing the government's considering reversing the Franco era decision that essentially put Spain in the wrong time zone.
I was in Madrid
Tell me why, Sebastian.
Because it was so nice to actually not as it is here in London when you get on your bike at 20 past 4 and it's already more or less dark. In Madrid, I there was still some sunlight in the sky at 20 past 5. I really liked it.
Rosemary, what about this idea, though, that it's
well, I don't like British summertime.
It's another... There's few
that do. At least...
idea of obliterating, what is essentially a sort of a Franco-era relic. Is it wrong to bring that sort of rhetoric even into this? And should we look at these things...
That is a bit weird. I agree. But if... if we're to understand it as coupled with revisiting the patterns of the working day, and they are all pinned to outdated criteria, be it the agricultural work cycle or indeed Franco's attitude towards Germany. I mean, why not do what is logical in the contemporary era? In terms of time zones and in terms of the working day. I thought the Spanish had already revised that away from the three-hour lunch. Because if you don't live near your home, you can't go home and have a rest. Mm. And in an era when everybody's commuting to work too. And then, you know, in Spain, lovely as the dinners are, they are awfully late in the day and you're supposed to get up again the next morning fairly early.
Just a final thought then, Sebastian. So it would be a big mistake. You're hoping that they stick to their guns on this.
Geographically, of course, they ought to change. Yeah, sentimentally, I think. But look, we've got Germany into the programme as well, so I'm very happy.
There you go. Sebastian's a happy man. Sebastian Borgert, thanks very much for being with us. Rosemary Hollis, likewise. Great to have you both with us here at Midori House. Today, the programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello. My thanks to her too. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager today was Kira and Matthew Banerjee. Thanks to them all. More music next at 1900 tonight. Section D coming your way. More on all the big stories of the day, some of which we've touched upon, and a few out of left field on the daily at 2200. This show, Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. Do join us then. But from me, Tom Edwards, and all the Tuesday team, thank you very much for tuning in.